Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Tetani of Dakota, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
We will not be afraid, despite whatever outcomes it comes, it lies within the national parliament. So I am truly confident of whatever decision that you will come, it will either make or break the current process.
Well, that's Bougainville's bid for independence from Papua New Guinea. Will it be that much closer? And who is responsible for the environmental risks posed by World War II shipwrecks in the Federated States of Micronesia?
My initial thought is that this very much sits with the local government in terms of how they're responding to this known potential issue arising from the wrecks that are located within Chuck Lagoon.
And is it time to go back to walking and horse riding if Tonga's fuel shortage continues? Well, those stories are shortly, but a big whakalovla I atu. Kia rana, no mai haere mai to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We're coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Dubow, and I appreciate your company this morning on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, Bougainville's bid for independence from Papua New Guinea has moved a big step closer, with the 2019 referendum results expected to reach Parliament by June next year. PNG Prime Minister James Marape says both Bougainville and PNG officials agreed during talks on Wednesday for a 2026 work plan which will lead to the tabling of the referendum result. More than 97.7% of Bougainvillians voted for independence in 2019, but its progress was stalled until former New Zealand Governor-General Jerry Mathaparai was brought in as a moderator. Mr. Marape says the technical details of what will happen in Parliament will be decided on over the next 3 months. Speaking at the start of the talks, Bougainville President Ishmael Torama says the results will go before PNG's Parliament as outlined in the 2001 Bougainville Peace Agreement.
The political understanding to which is 97.7 has been, voted by the people. It's a great opportunity for our people. Whatever happens, I think my first statement is we will not be afraid. We are not afraid. Because it's the National Parliament that has given us the political leverage into amending the Part 40. And from there, we are working our way towards. My co-chair, Bougainville, leaders and the people, we will not be afraid. Whatever outcome it may be, as the Parliament ratifies the outcome, it is your doing. Whatever consequences that lies between that is something that we will all walk our way through. We have been part and partners of this peace process. It stands really tall as Mount Williams, as we have, the message comes in. So I would like to make a very frank statement here this morning, saying that we are not afraid, and we will not be afraid, despite whatever outcomes it comes. It lies within the National Parliament. So I am truly confident of whatever decision that you will come, it will either make or break the current process moving forward.
And that's Bougainville President Ishmael Torama speaking at the Joint Supervisory Board body meeting in Port Moresby yesterday. Now, an expert on maritime law says a lawsuit in Federated States of Micronesia may provide additional incentive for the international community to do more to deal with the environmental risks posed by World War II shipwrecks. The Kasalelia Press reports locals in Chuuk have filed a lawsuit in the Supreme Court seeking to assign a responsibility for the damage caused by an oil spill from the wreck of the Japanese warship Rio de Janeiro Maru in September. The complaint alleges brownish-orange oil contaminated mudflats, mangroves, fishing grounds and caused the deaths of four people, for which the plaintiffs are seeking wrongful death damages for their families. The governments of FSM, Japan and the United States are named as defendants, along with a dive boat operator alleged to have played a role in triggering the spill. Professor Donald Rothwell from the Australian National University says while any potential legal obligations will likely fall on the FSM government, the case could spur more diplomatic and political pressure for greater action on dealing with wartime shipwrecks.
The law of the sea provides the general framework and the background here, but ultimately the marine pollution that's arising as a result of the oil leakage from the vessel is really occurring within the waters of the Federated States of Micronesia. That means that the core obligation with respect to clean-up, with respect to the environmental damage and the pollution arising, it really rests with the Federated States of Micronesia. So it doesn't immediately have international implications, though of course it has international connections, given it going back to events arising from World War II, and that this is a Japanese warship that was sunk during World War II. But it's really very much relating to the events in and around and associated with the September 2025 oil spill.
Given that, what do you think the likelihood of either the US and Japanese governments getting involved, responding, or even being part of this action, do you think?
Yeah, no, I think we need to make a distinction here between the legal obligations of the United States and the Japanese as opposed to whatever responsibility they might accept with respect to any cleanup actions which might arise irrespective of the outcome of these particular proceedings. So it may well be that as a result of the prominence being given to this particular event, the American and Japanese governments might step in to provide additional levels of assistance to the Federated States of Micronesia with respect to the oil contamination and the cleanup process. But in terms of legal obligations, my initial thought is that this very much sits with the local government in terms of how they're responding to this known potential issue arising from the wrecks that are located within Chuuk Lagoon, and the fact that at face value, the government hasn't necessarily taken appropriate action to ensure that any potential oil spillage from those known wrecks hasn't been contained, certainly in relation to the events of September 2025.
It's an interesting case in that, as you said, there's this overlap of historical and current issues. We spoke to you last month about the oil spill itself and the obligations of states like the Japanese and the United States to help clean up this spill. You said at the time it's a grey area. Does the fact that these wrecks have now caused some damage, including allegedly four deaths, does that change at all now that these wrecks, there has been an impact from these wrecks being left there for decades?
It doesn't really change the legal situation as it exists at the moment. It still remains a grey area. But what it does do is that it creates an additional political and diplomatic incentive to try to get some of these issues resolved. And to that end, the international efforts to try to get a clearer international legal framework with respect to these historic wartime wrecks hasn't really advanced very far. But the prominence being given to this case will provide additional incentives to try to get some resolution of these issues moving forward.
Given what you've said about how this is largely a domestic issue relating to the responsibilities of the FSM government to deal with these wrecks and the pollution that has now come from them, you think there's little to no chance that either the US or the Japanese will get involved in the court case or could potentially at some point in future be found liable?
Well, certainly both the United States and the Japanese will be very concerned about any legal precedent being created. So it may well be that they might become involved in this civil case, if only just to protect their own interests. But given the potential for these issues to arise all throughout the Pacific, I think both the Americans and the Japanese will be keen to ensure that there's no real legal precedent set here, which creates significant ongoing obligations for them.
And that's Professor Donald Rothwell from the Australian National University speaking to Liam Fox.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursdays at 4 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Morena and welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Papua New Guinea, where MP and Tourism Minister Beldon Nama has welcomed the proposal of a 10-kilometre buffer zone along its land border with Indonesia. The zone was proposed in talks between PNG, Indonesia and Australia as a way of curbing illegal activity at the border of the two countries. Mr Nama's constituency of Vanimo Green River District lies directly on the border, and he says a buffer zone would benefit the people of his area. He told ABC's Lucy Cooper that Papua New Guinea needs to be more proactive in border surveillance.
I have actually been fighting for this for a long, long time. You see, where the Wutung border, where the current, what do we call it, Batas, it's like a trade center between Papua New Guinea and Indonesia. Personal belief is that the Indonesians have built their infrastructures way into the PNG territory. So I've been saying that there must be a 10 kilometers buffer zone. There must be a 10 kilometers buffer zone. I've also been against Indonesians building their naval bases at the mouth of River Torasi in Western Province. I've been against Indonesians building their military infrastructure, civilian infrastructure, way into the border or into the territory of Papua New Guinea. And PNG government has not been very proactive in terms of border surveillance, border monitoring and all that. So your question about my position on a proposal to buffer zones, I fully support it. 100%. There should be a 10 kilometers buffer zone. Like in my trade in Vanimo, where there is a trade taking place in the Wutung border, the Indonesians should be on the other side of the border and Papua New Guinea infrastructure on this side of the border. So the river should be the natural demarcation between Indonesia and Papua New Guinea.
Given you fully support it, can we just reiterate why you think it is needed?
It is needed because, you know, we've had in many occasions, Indonesians have encroached into PNG territory for many reasons. Firstly, they've been poaching for, in Western Province, they after deer meat, poaching for fish in Lake Murray, other areas of Western Province for like Barramundi and all other stuff, and even buying gold from the people along the border. That's one reason. And the other reason is they've been encroaching to our side of the border, in pursuit of the fight against the West Papuan opium rebels who are fighting for the rights over their territory. The other thing is that it will make it easier for surveillance of, human smuggling, illicit trade of drugs, guns, and all this. illegal activities that are happening along the border. So in Vanimo, I would want the Indonesians to be on the other side of the River Tami, we on this side, and that's a go all the way to the mouth of River Torasi in Western Province.
If a buffer zone was established, could your constituents move back and forth?
Of course. Of course, if a buffer zone is established, I don't mind within the buffer zone if we my people can move back and forth. As long as there is this arrangement with Indonesians. Traditionally, we have families, relatives living across the other side of the border. The border line is just an imaginary line. But prior to the imaginary line coming into place, in the past, we used to go and visit our families on the other side of the border. Like we have villages who are on the other side.
How do you hope this is all going to play out?
Well, because the Indonesians have not been honouring the 10 kilometres buffer zone, and they have been doing this illegally all the time. And I've raised this many times on the floor of Parliament. I've had debates on it on the floor of Parliament. And I've actually asked my Prime Minister and my Foreign Minister to go to the United Nations to get the coordinates, to be able to demarcate the real border mark, and then we have a clear buffer zone between the two countries, so there is no encroachment. No country in the world would want another country to encroach into the side of the border, and you understand that very well. Normally, in other countries, there would be already war. I'm not saying that there should be war, or it might trigger war. I'm saying that there must be a respect of our land boundaries, our sea boundaries. So I would call for a neutral person, United Nations, to actually come and conduct the border survey so we have a clear demarcation of the buffer zone. So Indonesians must stay where they should stay, and we stay where we should stay. And there is this allowance of 10 kilometres buffer zone between the two countries.
And that's a Member of Parliament for PNG's Vanimo Green River District, Beldon Nama. And he was speaking there to ABC's Lucy Cooper. Well, it's at Tonga now, where the countdown has started towards finding out who will be the next Prime Minister. December 15th has been set as the day when MPs will elect the Prime Minister. And in the meantime, MPs have been given until next Friday to submit their nominees for the top job. But who exactly is in the running for the top post? Well, to help us answer that question, we're joined by our reporter in Tonga, Marion Kupel. That I say, Maro tama o bongbongini, Marion, fefe. Well, say a bit of malo. Thank you very much. Look, Marion, I know we've been having this conversation for quite a bit for the last few weeks. We're now at that point where it's election time for who could possibly be the next Prime Minister, right? So, but firstly, I'm just wondering, what has the atmosphere been like in Tonga with this race to secure who the next Prime Minister will be?
Besides being the weather being hot, eggy, the atmosphere here is a mix of quiet lobbying and a lot of Tongans just trying to get also, yes, you heard it, fuel for the week.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
behind the scenes, though, there is also MPs are definitely moving around. They've been visiting each other, a lot of phone calls, a lot of a little talano session here and there. They're just making sure they have the numbers. And, you know, it's calm on the outside, but definitely politically, it's very busy amongst them. And everybody knows that December the 15th is the big day, and we're all looking forward to that.
Yeah. Well, Marion, there has to be some possible candidates. Are there favourites? Are you able to name some of those who might be in the race for being PM?
Yes, sure. Certainly. Right now, the names that are floating around our Lord Fafanua, we have Dr. Isaac Eke, and also former Prime Minister Celci Sovaleni. These three are the ones that have been talked about the most. Although none of them have publicly declared, it's that Tongan classic.
Looks like
confirming.
Marin, sorry, we just probably lost you briefly there for a moment. Are you able to just to repeat that?
Oh, yes. So right now the names floating around are Lord Fafanua, the outgoing Speaker of the House. We also have Dr. Isaac Eke, the current Prime Minister, and also former Prime Minister Celci Sovaleni. These are the three ones that have been talked about the most. Although no one have publicly declared, it's a very Tongan style, like Eggy. Everyone's talking about it. No one's confirming.
Well, look, if no one's confirmed anything at the moment, what do we actually know then about the three that you've mentioned, like Fafanua, Eke and Sovaleni?
Yes, I'm happy you asked that question, Eggy, because these three are very different contenders and they are very different. They have very different strengths. Let's start with Celci Sovaleni, the former Prime Minister, whose term ended early after a rift with the palace. He's 55 years old, he's highly experienced, and has worked across the government, from finance to public enterprises, and even regionally. He has worked for regional bodies like ADB, NSBC, to name a few. He entered parliament in 2014, later served as Deputy Prime Minister under Achilles Poiva, and also won the 2021 PM race. At that time, it was we were struggling with tsunami and volcanic eruption, and also with COVID, which he managed to lead Tonga. It's always been said that he was baptized as PM with fire and water, meaning volcanic eruption and also the tsunami. When we come to Dr. Isaac Eke, the current caretaker prime minister, he's 64 years old and very much a technocrat. He's been in parliament since 2010, except for one term that he did not make. His former secretary for He's held the finance portfolio under both Nobles-led and Democratic-led governments back in 2010. His strength is also in financial management and stability, but insiders say he struggles to keep his cabinet united. He does have a few loyal returning MPs, but politically, he may be on the track foot, let's say, in trying to find to build the majority support now for the race. That's Isaac Eke. Now we have Lord Fafanua. Lord Fafanua is a very young noble. He's only 40, but also one of Tonga's most political figures. He entered parliament at 24 years old. He became the youngest speaker in Tongan history at age 27, and he has presided over major political reforms here and there. Of course, he's well-educated. He's very internationally connected, and he's active in youth, climate change policy, and anything related to that patch. Many people see him as matured and stable ever since he started. But his candidacy also raises debate because if a noble becomes PM, Aggie, some worry it could tilt the political power back to the nobility and the monarchy. Mm-hmm. So for Lord Fafanua is also the Crown Princess's brother and owns a lot of one of the few big estates here in Tonga. So really, Aggie, you have like a crisis-tested former prime minister, and then you have a finance expert, and then you have a reform-minded young noble all together running three very different paths for Tonga, you know, depending on who the MPs choose on the 15th of December. And each of them, they bring in a different style. And that's why the lobbying is very quiet, very intense, and very, very behind closed doors.
Those are three very different contenders that you have described there, Marion. And because of that, are we able to know what's the actual process, though, you know, now with actually trying to submit nominations for that prime minister role?
Yeah, like you mentioned earlier, the MPs have until next Friday, that's December the 12th, to hand in their nomination forms. After that, they'll meet on December the 15th to vote by a secret ballot. It's very, very procedural. There's no speeches, no campaigning inside the chamber, just a very quiet vote. And whoever gets the majority becomes the prime minister designate. It's very simple.
Yeah. Well, yes, and we shall await and see that. I know you've said that, of course, they'll be elected. So it's they make the selection, but is the announcement also made on the same day? Is it? Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Well, the announcement, I what I do know with the process, it will then be taken to His Majesty before it can publicly announce.
Yeah.
But you know, but this is Tonga Aegi. By the time it reaches the palace of the palace office, the whole half of Tonga would know by then.
Oh, that beautiful coconut wireless.
yes, exactly.
And you, what was interesting, you brought up something just before there in your commentary was, you know, in the likelihood of someone like, you know, we talk about Lord Whakawhanua, if he was being elected as PM, you know, what does that actually mean for Tonga? Because, yes, there possibly could be that pushback, right, towards the nobility and monarchy.
Aggie, that question has already been asked, especially around social media, amongst the Tongans, not only here in Tonga, but also around the world. If a noble becomes prime minister and the speaker's position also traditionally goes to a noble, then the people will wonder whether the balance of power is tilted back towards the nobility and the monarchy. It is constitutional, but it would definitely spark conversation about what the 2010 big political reform were meant to achieve, you know. Yeah. Some will see it as the stability. Others might see it as a shift of power. So it will spark a lot of conversation in this.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure another big question is that, look, once someone is appointed as PM, I mean, what really are the pressing issues that Prime Minister will really have to address first? I'm assuming the fuel shortage, maybe?
Yes, Aggie, fearful. That's the biggest headache at the moment. We've already started experiencing the fuel shortage yesterday after being calm for a few days. Now it's picking up yesterday. And then the cost of living, obviously, is always probably a major concern all around the Pacific. There's also government finances. We also have the aviation issue. Having said that, I'm talking about the Lulutai airline issue. And these are some of the issues. We also have restoring trust in the public services, given that a government or a prime minister changes every 4 years. And now we've seen endless or incomplete leadership in our Tongan government since 2010. Support or justify what I just said there is, since the reform in 2010, The only full-term prime minister was Lord Duvagano. That was from 2010 up to 2014. Mm. Since then, no prime minister have had a conflict term. You know, it's either they were dissolved by His Majesty. Some of them, they had vote of no confidence. And, you know, lately is there's the resignation of Celso Sovaleni that we've just experienced. So no prime minister have had a full term since Lord Duvalno in 2010. So that should be a concern also.
Yeah, but definitely, yeah, a lot of things to have to contend with, a lot of issues there that you have brought up. And so, yeah, Marion, as always, mālo pitenga o fa mihina. We appreciate you joining us on the show this morning.
Mālo pito eki o fātou.
That is Marion Kupu, ABC's reporter in Tonga. Well, we are staying in the kingdom where the traffic may be flowing today in Nuku'alofa, but it was a different story several weeks ago, with long lines forming at service stations as Tonga's capital was rocked by a fuel shortage. While the issue may be solved for now, there's fears it's only a temporary fix, with an ongoing storage problem likely to cause more trouble. But as ABC's Whenau Whanua reports, there could be a silver lining to the country's fuel troubles.
Long queues of vehicles lining up to refuel at a petrol station. It's something Tongans have grown used to. Sporadic fuel shortages have led to petrol stations shutting their doors to customers, with only a handful staying open for business. Fuel shortages have occurred in the last 3 months, with many drivers forced to wait for hours.
I waited for more than 2 hours just to get enough petrol to last us a few days. It was extremely frustrating.
Tonga's Prime Minister Aisaka Eke urges the public to be patient and to be economical. He said an ongoing maintenance operation of the country's fuel depot was the cause of the sudden fuel shortages, and that a strategy plan to increase storage capacity and introduce electric vehicles was currently in place to avoid future disruptions. The fuel disruptions has the public frustrated.
It was learning to allocate time and resources and only go to places that were essential and no more going to unnecessary road trips.
The fuel shortages have also been a burden for businesses.
We affected by that, not run much during the day.
Reniti Dhamma is the owner of the Friendly Taxi Tours, a popular taxi company in Tonga. She's refused to increase taxi fees, taking a hit on revenue.
So now most of our colleagues at the airport try to fill up a tram to save their home before the run out of petrol.
But there's a silver lining to Tonga's fuel woes. In this 1980s video, a family rides via horseback in Nuku'alofa. During those times, walking and horse riding was the main form of transport in Tonga. But as Tongan's overseas diaspora grew, so did remittances and the importation of vehicles. According to the Ministry of Infrastructure, there were over 3,000 vehicles in Tonga in 2024. A conversation has been happening. Many complain there are too many vehicles and that people just need to walk more. Tonga's fuel crisis could just be the thing to drive the public towards healthier living, more affordable living, and a cleaner environment.
And that there is Whenau with that report.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your life or home isn't. Learn what to do before, during, and after disaster in a program aimed at helping you keep safe. Pacific Prepared is all things disaster preparedness for the Pacific, with a team of reporters on the ground, having conversations, and bringing you the stories that could help you, your family, and community prepare for natural disasters. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Bongi Mania and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Pacific nations have seen a devastating rise in rates of HIV and AIDS, according to the United Nations AIDS report. Fiji has been particularly badly hit with hundreds of new infections this year, since cuts to the US aid programs were made by the Trump administration. Helen Evans is from the Pacific Friends of Global Health.
It's actually really devastating. There's an estimate that there may be as many as 3,000 new cases by the end of this year. And we're still grappling, along working closely with the Fiji government and community groups there, to try and get a handle on it. It's largely driven by injecting drug use, and significantly amongst young populations. Most concerningly, apparently some of the infections are amongst children as young as 10 years old. So it is a huge concern.
And which programs have been cut because of the withdrawal of US funding? And is that adding to the problem?
I'm not sure that it's adding to the problem in Fiji, but it's certainly adding to the problem globally when they've cut such a massive amount of funding. And they've cut funding to organisations like UNAIDS, which provides a lot of support, and WHO, which provides a lot of support as well. So I think that the announcement made yesterday by the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, that we're going to commit $408 million to assist in Fiji's epidemic and more broadly in the Pacific, is really very welcome, and it really shows Australia's leadership. When a number of large nations are stepping back from their development assistance support, it's terrific to see that Australia's maintained its commitment. It's not just Fiji, though. I mean, Papua New Guinea also declared HIV as a national emergency in the middle of this year, where they've had a significant increase in their infections as well. And it's really tragic, where we were really on track globally to eliminate HIV by 2030, and we're still on track in Australia, which is a great achievement. And it was achievable, but the significant cut in funding, particularly the US funding, but not only the US funding, a number of big US, UK, the UK, for instance, and EU donors have also cut their support, having to make a choice, whether it's they have to, between defence and development, whereas I think the two should go hand in hand. So it's a very different scene, yes.
As you said, there has been a huge increase in new cases and infections in Fiji and other places in the Pacific. How many people, though, go on to develop AIDS? How many people are living with HIV? In other words, what's happening with treatments and antivirals?
If you're on treatment, I mean, that was the big breakthrough in 1996 with the antiretroviral treatment that changed HIV/AIDS from a death sentence to a manageable communicable disease. But you need to be on the treatment to manage the HIV. And when people can't access treatment, and there are a lot of people now who are receiving treatment through funded programs who aren't accessing it. And UNAIDS are estimating that as many as 3 to 4 million new infections will result by 2029 if funding isn't restored to provide treatment to people. It's not. It's both preventing HIV. It's also preventing vertical transmission of HIV. For instance, in Africa, HIV is more prevalent amongst women, and if they're HIV positive and they're on treatment, you can actually prevent the transmission of HIV through to their child. But if they're not on treatment, then you're also going to get not only the mother but the child infected. So, yeah, we're looking for a big increase.
And that's Helen Evans from the Pacific Friends of Global Health, and the reporter there was Ross Childs. Well, between TV, radio, newspapers, and in recent decades, online devices, there are countless ways for people to access information. But in the Pacific, it's been unclear how audiences are choosing to access information until now. BBC Media Action has carried out audience research across Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea, Samoa, Tonga, Vanuatu, and Fiji, just to understand how they access, trust, and even engage with media. We have Deepak Batarai, the project's Pacific Director, and he joins us on the line from Fiji. We gotta say Yandra, Deepak.
Yandra Vinakayagi.
Thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate your time. I have to say, of the six countries you've researched, what are the most popular sources of media?
Thank you so much for having me too. So now we have seen that the people are moving towards the digital platforms from the traditional media platforms like radio, television, and newspaper. So most of the people are getting information from social media platforms. And still we found Facebook is the one who is dominating a lot in the Pacific. But when there are any kind of emergencies or big events, then people will go to radio, television, and newspaper for confirming the information. The other one is radio is still prominent in many of the places because the internet is not trustworthy, especially in Papua New Guinea, that we found that, and in Tonga as well. And in Fiji, it's a little bit different because there is good internet penetration over here. And the other interesting thing is when people need for the information in Papua New Guinea, still word of mouth. So getting the secondhand information from their families, friends is quite high rather than any other Pacific islands. But there are some isolated Pacific islands which are still getting information from their friends and families.
Yeah, that's a lot of differences, right? Probably in the last sort of 10, 20 years. Is that what you were saying? Like these results differ from country to country, as you say, just dependent on internet or the resources that they have in that country?
Yeah, exactly, Aggie. So what we have found is, especially in Solomon's, Vanuatu, and even in Tonga, radio is the one like which reaches to the wider audience. So in terms of access, they have more access to the radio in the traditional media. And with the internet coming up and up, and there are new towers have been building, new networks have been working. And in Fiji, there is already 5G, and other countries are also working for 5G and still using 4G. So people are getting different information from the different sources, and it varies in the different countries. So with the, it depends more on the infrastructure and how connected are the islands. For some of the islands, it's very hard to get newspaper and it goes after a week. Right. And even in Tonga, if I give an example, there is no newspaper as such. There are church newspaper, but there are not daily or weekly newspaper that that people read it. And some of the newspaper that used to be in the past in the Pacific have stopped producing a newspaper. They are only on the online. But radio are still active. And people are still listening to the radio, but in terms of the wider, it is Facebook, and TikTok is coming up that we have seen, and YouTube and Instagram.
Well, as you say, that radio is still up there. That's good to hear, as we are, you know, a program that airs out to the radio stations out in the Pacific region. Deepak, I want to know though, any trends or any elements of your research that probably surprised you the most?
So one of the thing that surprised me most is people's confidence on finding that and telling that they can know when there is misinformation, disinformation, false information. They have very high confidence in the Pacific that they can spot it well. But when we deep dive into it, that confidence doesn't mean that they have that tools, that they have that knowledge and experience. So it is quite surprising as well as alarming. It's a flag that people feel very confident when we ask the questions. And another one that we have found a lot everywhere in the Pacific, and especially in Samoa and Tonga, and even in Vanuatu, is people, when we ask about their challenges, about the life, the most of them is talking about supporting their family. So it seems like people are so connected. The family, the community comes very high on the top with the Pacific Islanders that we have seen. And on that data, there is a slightly less in Fiji than any other countries. So that means Fiji has maybe gone to a little bit more individualistic society, but others are still more on community and family. That is one thing surprised me. The other one is about the alcohol and drugs, about the challenges. When we ask about people, what are the nation's biggest challenges? Always top three will be in each and every country. One will be alcohol and drugs. And some of the country in Vanuatu, it is the highest one, followed by cost of living. So there is so much of alcohol and drugs issues that people have felt in these Pacific Islands. I think this research has prominently has shown that data. So yeah, that also surprised me how much people are worried about it.
Wow. Look, if you are just joining us, my guest this morning is Deepak Batharai, BBC Media Actions Project's Pacific Director, speaking to me on how the region accesses information a lot of times through media. So Deepak, you know, again, what's sort of the economic challenges, you know, threatening public interest media, and how can it best adapt?
So when we ask people, we ask about their main challenges, and one is definitely as I said earlier, cost of living, finding a job, and they want media to support on that. They want more information on economic issues, so that they can have that informed decisions where they can find jobs, how they can address the cost of living issues, as well as they have some shared about where they can go for the migrating for the works and finding the jobs abroad as well. And other issues that I found quite interesting is about the expense that they do in social media platforms. It's also rising. Like in Fiji, we did the time that they spend in social media is above half of the population is spending more than 3 hours per day. It's a huge numbers on their mobile phones. And when they say mobile phones, it's mostly the social media, but sometimes they do it for calling and messaging. And the expense that they do it is 30 Fijian dollar. And it varies in each country, but the expense that they are putting on their mobile phones is also quite high. And we have some, we did the research launch last week and last month in different countries, Fiji last week. What we found from the telecom operators is they are giving some data specific for the social media platforms, which is quite, they want to make it more value for money. But still, people are spending their half-day income or a full-day income, and for some of them, a weekly income on their social media platforms for a month.
Wow. I'm wondering then, Deepak, you know, because Australia has a strong trend, right, towards news avoidance. Is that the case in the Pacific, or do you think people really are actively seeking out news?
That's a very interesting question. So it also varies in the country. So when we asked about how much are you interested on the news, and we also check them how much they have consumed the information that they have consumed last week and last month. So most of the people, when we're asking about news and current affairs, they say like they have a high interest on it, and especially in Fiji, Papua New Guinea, they said they have high interest in news. But when we check the consumption of the information, it seems like they are more consuming the infotainment. So it is more entertainment, more movies, songs, and there is more about the information, more about the social media influencers and content creators, entertainment content. That's what we have found. But when we ask about it, they usually say that we have high interest on news and current affairs. It seems like media organizations need to work a bit much more on the strategies and maybe the storytelling. That's what we have discussions with the different media organizations over the Pacific.
Well, Deepak, with the research that you've done, is this now meant to help, you know, media organizations better serve their audiences?
Definitely, Yagi. So that was the main purpose of this research. We want them to serve their audience better. So we have done the audience profile of different media organizations. So in Fiji, we have done for six. In Tonga, we have done for five. In Samoa, we have done for six. In Vanuatu, we have done for two. So in different countries, we have done the different numbers of media organizations, their audience profile. So we have gone down to the gender. We have gone down to the geographic locations, gone down to the different age groups, their education level. So now the media organizers have understood who are their audience, what are their challenges, what are their main source of information, where do they trust much more. And that would be definitely helpful to make their strategies as well as serve their audience better.
And I think what I'm hearing from, you know, what you're saying this morning, Deepak, is that whole thing around trust, right? What our audiences trust. So is that what you're saying is what we need to maintain in terms of sharing information online?
Definitely. So trust, in terms of the trust, still people have much more trust, and it shows in all the different countries that the research has done, that people go for verifying information either on radio. Radio is the most one. And then it comes to TV, and then it comes to newspaper, verifying the information. But people are so much confident about making sure that they understand when there is a rumor, when there is a false information, when there is a misinformation or disinformation. They feel that confidence. And sometimes, like, people have shared, one of the examples that I was like so much flagging was, when I see any information on social media, to make it confirm, I will post it again so that there will be a comment. And then when I will know if it is just rumor, false information, or is it accurate information. That is something. That's so challenging. Yeah. And the other thing.
Deepak, I'm going to have to cut you off there. We've only got about 30 seconds left of the show.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
but look, you. It's been very fascinating what you've been sharing this morning. So really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Angie. Thank you so much for having me here.
No worries. That is Deepak Bathirai, BBC Media Actions Project's Pacific Director, here on Pacific Beat, bringing us to the end of Pacific Beat. Remember, you can find our top stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Now, the team will be back tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. So stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, o toa o whaantum, this is Aggie Tobol on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.